Hi, and welcome to the Crowdsourcing Sustainability Podcast. My name is Michaela.
And I'm Ryan.
And we're your co-hosts. This podcast exists to help inform, inspire, and empower people to take action on climate. We'll do this by bringing on wonderful sustainability leaders, listening to their stories, and exploring meaningful actions we can all take. This episode comes from a webinar we filmed recently on eco-anxiety. If you're interested in seeing the slides that went along with this webinar, you can find the video on our YouTube channel, Crowdsourcing Sustainability, which we'll link to in the podcast description. Hope you enjoy! Hey everybody, welcome to the webinar. Today we will be discussing eco-anxiety with the co-founder of Eco-Anxious Stories, Rachel Molina Chan. Rachel, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thanks so much for having me, Ryan and Michaela, and thanks for everyone who's joining us. It's really humbling that this many folks want to hear us chat, so thank you. My name is Rachel Molina Chan. I live in Victoria, British Columbia in Canada on the traditional territories of the Lekwungen-speaking peoples, known today as the Songhees and the Esquimalt. My family is from European ancestry, and I'm a settler on these lands, so I like to start out my talks just acknowledging that that's a perspective that I'm bringing, and it's a limited one. But it also holds a lot of privilege in this day and age. So I'm trying to use it today to shed some light on those power dynamics. I'm originally from the prairies of Canada in Saskatchewan, and that's where I did 2 degrees at the University of Saskatchewan, first in political studies and then in community health and epidemiology. And so my lens on the climate crisis and on eco-anxiety is really about health and how health sort of actually trickles down from all of these broader determinants, including the environment, to our individual life, and how that web can be really complicated and kind of overwhelming to know sort of how do we make ourselves well? How do we make our communities and our families well? How do we make our planet well if we're that interdependent and that small at the end of the day? And so my work as a storyteller and as a communication strategist is really about helping people find their power in their story. And that's what we're going to get into today, I think.
Awesome. So just to kind of build off that and dive in a bit further, Rachel, I'd love for you to start just by talking about how you got into climate in the first place, what the like key moments were in your journey to getting to where you are now, and just why this matters to you. I think it's always super useful and interesting to hear how people got to where they are.
Totally. Yeah. Thanks for inviting my story to start this out. I would say my story about climate change really only starts about 6 years ago for me in terms of when I started to articulate and talk about my story in terms of the climate crisis and how I was feeling about it. That was when I was just about to start my master's program. And I was already pretty active in my community working on issues of social and environmental justice. I was part of a leadership program called Next Up Saskatchewan. And it was all about bringing young people kind of in their late teens, early 20s, early 30s together to talk about how we build skills and support each other to make the world tangibly better for people, especially for those who face oppression and systemic racism, sexism, ableism, and stuff like that. And so I was in those spaces and learning about all these ways I can make change and learning more about storytelling as a tool for change making. And yet, I wasn't really hearing much about climate change. And so I was trying to figure this out, why, you know, I was living in a province where the politicians and a lot of the big industry were very much not talking about climate change. It's a oil and gas and resource extraction heavy industry and economy in Saskatchewan. And so I kind of knew why maybe we weren't hearing about it a lot in the media or for politicians. But my own friends and the people that I knew in the health sector, I was like, these are really good people who care a lot about this stuff. And they're even thinking about it in terms of systems. And yet I'm not really seeing climate change as like a major component of that. And I wanted to know why, because I wasn't convinced that it was that they didn't know enough or didn't care enough. And I wanted to explore what I was perceiving to be a gap between sufficient knowledge, not a lack of understanding or a lack of knowledge, but sufficient knowledge and meaningful mobilization, the kind of action that wasn't just kind of token or tacit, but really changed things.
It's awesome and super, super important research. Yeah, that's actually how we got connected in the first place. I saw you posted your dissertation. I was like, this is information that just seems so crucial for this moment in time. Like, what is that gap? But before we dive into that, I'd love to hear how that, like, I'm sure this is part of the reason, but how did you decide to start Eco Anxious Stories? Mm-hmm. And what is that exactly?
Yeah, so I am the co-founder of Eco Anxious Stories. It's a website and kind of online project that I started with my brother-in-law, Kevin Gatley, about a year ago. And that project really came out of my own experience with writing my thesis and exploring the stories of people who do know enough but are struggling to find a meaningful way to plug into climate action. That was my lens. And then Kevin's was that he had made it till, you know, his midlife not really knowing a lot about climate change and not really knowing a lot about what he could be doing about it, especially as a person of privilege. And to be frank, when I would bring him to climate events in town here, he often felt like he was sticking out a little bit and that he didn't know the lingo and didn't feel super comfortable in the space. And that's just, you know, the nature of kind of joining a new culture and subculture and stepping out of your comfort zone. But he and I started chatting about how it would be nice to have a place where people didn't already have to identify as part of the solution, but that they were welcomed in on the basis of their fears and their concerns, and that we would help move them and create a safe space to still talk about, like in a critical way, what it means to use our stories and ourselves and our power to make the world a better place and to care for each other better. But that the starting point to that often doesn't feel like standing up as a leader. Often it feels like crawling on your knees to support. And so we wanted to frame a project that it wasn't meant to be everything to everyone, but for those people who maybe come from a place of privilege and maybe are trying to sort out how they feel about this distance between what they know and what they're doing, that we would try to create a safe place for that to happen while also pushing for that analysis of that we're all interconnected, that we all have different levels of power and influence, and that it's really important to tap into that to have a meaningful and sustained response.
That's awesome. So could you speak a little bit about what is eco-anxiety and why do people get it?
I think I said this to you guys both on the prep call, but really eco-anxiety means different things to different people at this stage. And I want to be clear that I'm not a social scientist that does big, massive questionnaires and polls and surveys to get lots of data that we can draw conclusions from. My thesis was a qualitative project that looked more at theories and frameworks of people's stories. So my information about what eco-anxiety is at that more research level is based on my conversations with people in that field and based on conversations with people in the clinical space as well, psychotherapists, psychologists, and psychiatrists, and folks in that sector who are trying to sort out this very emerging feeling. So my short answer is that eco-anxiety is a feeling of worry or dread or fear about the climate crisis or other ecological degradation, because climate crisis is really one symptom of a much broader combination of impacts that we're seeing play out. And of course, then there's social and political underpinnings to all of that as well. So we're talking about the uncomfortable feelings that relate to our relationship to the ecological crises we're facing.
Do you have any idea how prevalent it is or how that's changed over time? Anything?
Yeah.
Because I feel like it's been so just like it wasn't talked about at all. And now it's starting to be talked about a bit, but it still feels like, and with climate change in general, there is this climate silence a lot of the time still for how big of an issue and story it is. So I'm just curious if you have any clue, like how many people have this? Is it common or?
Yeah, I think one thing we can safely say is that the numbers are increasing and that the attention on the numbers are increasing. I did a quick search last night to get caught up on the studies that have been done. And a lot of them, I will say, are happening in English-speaking and sort of Western countries. So that's one thing to be clear on, is that this isn't necessarily a term, climate anxiety or eco-anxiety. It's not necessarily being used in every place on Earth. And so that clues us into that there's something kind of cultural happening here. And while this might be a sort of universal experience, there might be different words or different ways of expressing this, depending on who you are and where you live and what language you speak. So the studies that have been done, there's one recently by Harris poll in the US that showed that 3 out of 4 millennials experience some type of eco-anxiety. In Canada, there was a poll out last summer by Abacus that saw that half of all people they polled were increasingly concerned about the climate crisis. One really striking one recently from a postdoc in Canada, there's a person I just became aware of named Ellen Fields, and she did a national survey of students in Canada and found that almost half of them believe that climate change is happening and that it's going to impact them negatively, but that there's nothing we can do to change it. And so there's, I think, the general trend that we're seeing. I often say that eco-anxiety is really, it's not about molecules and what's happening in sort of the atmosphere. It's about our relationships and our power dynamics between different communities. And I think what we're seeing is people who, younger people, might feel like they have less power to actually change what they know, to not be able to bridge that space between their knowledge and what they would see as a meaningful response at large to the climate crisis. And so often we do hear about young people's anxieties around this. We know for a fact that climate change impacts people of color, Black and Indigenous bodies, and people in the global South first and worst. And so while those communities might be feeling these impacts and might be feeling the emotional and mental impacts of those crises as well, I do want to be clear that they may not be using these terms to describe their experience. So often I'm seeing people who look like me, people who have privilege, people who have white skin, people who might have a bit of an attachment to the status quo, expressing themselves in terms of anxieties right now. And that's usually where we focus, because that's who we are and that's where our community is. And that's where we think we can help along the conversation, that if your primary feeling about what's happening right now is anxiety, let's use that to tap into thinking about what you love and what you care about and what you might need to grieve or process in order to move towards a more fulsome story about your eco-anxiety towards a meaningful response.
Could you go over some of those steps that people take to change their anxiety into meaningful action and how to go from this feeling of hopelessness and that you can't do anything about it to actually using that feeling to, you know, make a difference and overcoming that fear?
Sure. I think it might be a good time to throw up the screen of my three-part model that we use for echoing stories. This framework sort of assumes that we're not here to educate people about climate change. We're characterizing the gap between what we know and the change that we're aiming for, not as a gap. And this comes from Renee Lertzman's work that I learned from when I was studying. This isn't a gap. This is a really complex psychosocial landscape. This is a jungle. This is a mountain. This is something that we're really trying to navigate and understand and work through constantly. And so we like to think of this mountain and this not a gap as a story, and a story with three acts, because as a person from my background, that's sort of a nice way for me to think about stories. This is a universal framework with lots of different structures, and this is a useful one as we're talking about climate change. So again, we start with this idea that our anxieties are real and they're coming from a place of sanity, not mental illness or not seeing things correctly as they are, but truly understanding things as they are is causing our anxieties. And this is complicated. As Ryan was saying, there's a lot of things going on here and we all need to find our place in it. And I was saying about this, our health and the social determinants of our health. This is bigger than us as individuals. So first act is, this is a complicated story. If you're feeling overwhelmed, you are seen, you are included, you belong. And here's some tips for getting back in your body and feeling like this is a story you're actually in and not just watching unfold. So getting in your body, getting a hold of your thought pattern, getting into tune with what you're actually telling yourself is a good way to just get into act one and not get overwhelmed. So for me, when I'm feeling those act one feelings of anxiety, I try to do yoga, I try to do breathing exercises, I try to reach out to a friend, I try to eat something delicious or see something that makes me smile, because these are ways that we can remember that we are in this story, we are characters in this story, and we are human beings with agency. And it's okay that it's complicated. We are complicated beings with complicated stories. So to hold space for those feelings and to not let them overwhelm us is step one. But the key is to not just cope with your feelings. And we try to really emphasize this, that this isn't about getting over your eco-anxiety. We're here to help you create a lifelong relationship with your eco-anxiety and to hold it in place with all the hope and motivation and capacity that you need to make a difference here. And so this is from Dan Rubin, another psychologist, psychotherapist that we work with. He says, anxiety is about love. You don't feel anxious about anything if you don't love anything. And so if you love your health and your body and yourself, that's something. If you love your family and those who might be at risk from the future or present impacts of climate change, that's your source of courage and compassion and solidarity in this movement. So lean into that. Surround yourself with those things and those people that you love and get really in tune with them. Let your eco-anxiety move you towards them, because that's where we're going to start to find that meaningful response. And if you move through complexity to love and then to meaning, that's where hopefully folks are able to find and tap into action that actually looks like something they can do, that actually feels like something that's good for them, and that reflects the creative, expressive human being that they are. And so that's where we try to get people to through eco-anxious stories in a small way, is to give them a chance to do something creative or something honest or something human about what it is they love in the complex story that they're telling.
That's awesome. There's so much to dive into here. I just want to reiterate something you said near the beginning of that, which I think is just so important, is to let people know who are feeling this, that it's completely a natural, rational response. Like, what's happening is terrifying. And just being able to acknowledge that and know that, like, yes, what you're thinking, like, you're not alone in thinking that. And it makes sense for you to feel that way as a person who cares about, you know, society, earth, life. It's just like a natural human response. And I think it's so powerful to, like you said, when you look kind of behind the scenes at, like, why are you feeling this way? It's happening because of that love. And I think that is, like, if you can harness that somehow, like, that can be a very powerful motivator to get over any stagnation or hopelessness, or it's just like the most powerful human emotion, I think. So I just appreciate you making those points.
Thank you. I think it also relates back to reminding people that this is more about when they are than who they are. Because we can assume that everyone loves something or someone that is going to be negatively impacted by the climate crisis, or is being negatively impacted by the climate crisis. And so this isn't about becoming an expert. That's one thing I found in my study, is none of my participants felt like experts. And so they didn't know what their role was. This, again, was about 5 years ago, so the discourse was a little different. But I think nowadays we really want to emphasize that if you want to be a part of making the world not go to shit, then you are on side. Like, you're with us, and we want you to find your role, and we're going to help you in that endeavor. But this isn't about being an expert or taking on a whole bunch of new educational information. This is really about tapping into what you already know and you already love and you already want to change.
That's awesome. You're going to say something, Michaela?
Yeah. Could you build onto that with some of the research you've done on it's not that people don't care about climate, it's that they don't know how to act or how to deal with these feelings.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So I'll just flip the slide here to show you a bit where I started in terms of my thesis. And I was really trying to, again, understand what this gap represented and how we might be able to use the structure and the framework of a story to help navigate what feels like distance between knowledge and action. And again, Renee Lertzman would encourage us to think of all of this stuff as being really just tangled and wrapped up in itself. Please know this is a 2D snapshot of the 3D life you're living. It's all happening all together all at once. And this is just sort of spreading it out for a moment in time, like a picture of real life, where we're just taking a snapshot and seeing how the dots connect. But essentially, I started with this idea that if we just look at people who have sufficient knowledge, what does the challenge of their story look like? I drew on Marshall Ganz's work around public narrative to think of challenge, choice, moral, challenge, choice, outcome, and moral. These are the sort of pillars of a story from at least a Western tradition, that we're thinking of characters who are facing some type of thing they have to overcome, who make meaningful choices that indicate to us what the end of the story results in, and then we draw value conclusions from that, morals, based on the meaning of the story. And there's things like genre and all kinds of things that are used to do that. But if we just look at a basic story, what is the challenge? Is climate change on the radar, or are these folks looking at other types of problems? It turned out in my study, most of my participants weren't actually actively like identifying their work as climate oriented, but most of them were working on issues like poverty or building up power among women or queer people or people of color, like that they were really working on things that are at the heart of the movement that I'm a part of when it comes to climate justice, but they didn't necessarily see themselves that way. So instead of Act One being about ignorance and them not knowing enough to care about the climate crisis, it was more about trying to connect the dots between what they already did know and care about and the climate crisis. So just make more about framing and being able to, instead of thinking of this as a lack of understanding, a lack of an ability to sort of hold these stories simultaneously or make them make sense. And it wasn't that they didn't care, but that the heart of the story was broken. This part in the middle where what we choose and what happens because of our choices didn't feel like it was going to add up. And so instead of apathy, which is what maybe we assume would be at the heart of this story, it was more about trying to sort through their relationship to what was happening. And sometimes that had more to do with them sorting out feelings of guilt or feeling like maybe I'm part of the problem, not part of the solution. Or maybe I'm part of these systems that are so rigid, I can't even imagine making any change in them. And so it was more about trying to sort out how they could actually reconcile their values and what they thought they could do with their power. I had one participant who said, you know, should I go into politics and in 20 years become prime minister with the hopes of setting better climate targets? Like, is that what I'm supposed to do to have some kind of systemic change? And maybe she should. But I think I understood her question there of like, that's going to take a lot of time. Is that really my theory of change? Like, is that where my power lies? And so it's hard. It's hard to see yourself as being powerful in this context. And so again, Act Three isn't about giving up, but it does feel more like not being able to access that kind of meaningful action rather than being about not wanting to do something. It's more like not being able to do something or having what you do be totally unsupported and condemned by your culture that you feel like an outsider and can't sustain it. So this is really the story I was disrupting. And I think that all of these ingredients were part of my participant story, part of my own personal story. But I really wanted to explore this concept of narrative dissonance. And this is a term I came up with in to be able to use in my thesis and talk about a contrast between something like cognitive dissonance, which mainly focuses on cognition, what we know, with what's in our hearts and what's going on with our hands and feet, our behaviors and our affect are part of this equation as well. And so by talking about stories rather than just what we know or understand, we can see you could have Act One all figured out and actually have a really strong understanding of climate change and still not know how to move to Act Two or Act Three. You could have Act Two figured out. You could be like, I really care about what I care about and I'm totally in solidarity with folks who are working on this, but I don't know my role. And that's a brokenhearted story. Or you could even have the heart of the story be strong and beating. And I think a lot of us are in this boat too, where you actually don't, you're not apathetic at all. It hurts so much, it's hard to get through the day. And trying to figure out how to get to Act Three, where you're actually having this like meaningful response, I think that's where we're really trying to build capacity. And so that's where my thesis really focused was, how can we think of this in terms of narrative dissonance instead of cognitive dissonance or apathy or even behavioral, you know, problems or lack of ability to change behaviors, and more think of it in terms of the story. I just have this sort of four-part breakdown. This is what came out of my thesis was the Act One has to be about a sense of agency. You have to identify as a character in this story, not just a bystander. You have to be in this story. And you have to have a job, like you have to have a role to play as this character. And I don't mean a profession, I mean like a purpose. And when you reconcile that purpose with like with what's at stake and actually connect the dots to what you want and have that sense of capacity, that's when the heart of the story gets repaired. And I see that as only happening through collaboration and connection and solidarity. And that's what gets us to action, the what will it take. But that's really different than committing yourself to this story. That's a different kind of action than, you know, recycling or getting out there and voting or organizing your community. So I think all of this full story needs to be at hand as we're exploring narrative dissonance and how we create narrative fidelity out of these apparent gaps in the story.
That is awesome and super useful. A super useful model to be thinking about this topic. Two of the things I heard there, which I want to dive into a bit, are the apathy or powerlessness, and like the people who are struggling to find their role in this story. So what, how do you help, like what tips do you have for people who are either at that powerlessness stage or this, like, I don't feel powerless, but I don't know where to plug in. Like, how do I figure out my role? Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice for each one of those?
Yeah, that's a great question. What came to mind as you were asking it was honestly, like, if you feel like the story about the climate crisis is sort of playing out for you, like indirectly, like if you feel like you're watching it on a screen right now, what I would encourage you to do is picture the camera pivoting to you and pivoting to, like, all of a sudden you as sort of like the character in the story. And really, for a moment, we don't want to center ourselves all the time, but a really key part of, I think, being reflective about our purpose in this story is to think of ourselves for a moment as one of the main characters. If this was about your story and how you sort of are making your choices and what you're hoping to achieve or what you want your life to mean, if you haven't done that already, just take some time to journal or talk to a friend or just think about that. Because I think that that's step one, is really confronting the fact that your emotions aren't about what's going to happen in the future, what's going to happen out there to other people. For a second, make it about what is going to happen to you or what you feel, because I think that that gets us to a more authentic expression of this story. And to confront what you feel ignorant about, like, do some research if you don't know exactly what you're worried about. But importantly, use eco-anxiety as a turning point in your story. And that's, we're used to seeing stories like this, like the turning point happens in act one and it sets off what's going to happen in act two. And I think eco-anxiety is such a good turning point. And it's a great way to, again, clue you into what you love and what you care about. So as the camera's focused on you, who else is in the screen? Who else is in your sphere of influence already? Maybe it's people you work with. Maybe it's people in your family. Maybe it's your local leaders. Maybe you're a local leader and it's your local constituents. Figuring out your role is all about repairing the heart of the story and figuring out what you already care about, what you already love, and where you can already make a difference. Because I think that's how we start to feel like our choices are meaningful. It's not when we close off our story to make it so small that all that matters is if I, you know, use a plastic bag today or not. That's not going to change the end of the story. That's narrative dissonance. That's me thinking that I'm way too big of a character than I actually am. But starting to understand what character you represent and who else is in your scene, who else you might need to actually look to for leadership, who might, which voices are not in your sphere of influence that you need to be listening to. I think thinking of this in those kinds of terms is a good way to just start reflecting on the role and the meaning that you might be able to discover. And it's not something that has to happen overnight. You starting to back up and actually think about your purpose, that's an incredible first step. And I hope that to be able to support people in that one-to-one, because it very much does have a different flavor no matter who you are. But definitely go looking. Go looking for people that you already feel comfortable with that you might be able to have a conversation with this about, because it's hard to redefine your identity and then start doing really hard things. It's easier to start to look to people in your life that can guide you and that you can guide and then take on work together.
That makes a lot of sense.
Could you tell us a little bit about the impact of your work and of this, you know, understanding, maybe some success stories you've experienced?
Sure. This is a screenshot of our website at Eco Anxious Stories and some captures of some of the content we've created over the last year. To be clear, we are completely unfunded and everything that you see is out of our own bank accounts and efforts and desires. We have a modest Patreon following that we really appreciate that helps keep the, you know, domain paid for and the stuff working, but no one gets paid to do this work and all of our contributions are volunteer as well so far. We'd really like to change that. But the point of this was to really just start to create a space where really, like, my friends and I could start to, like, put some of the creative work that we've been thinking about and doing, and to give me an excuse to interview super interesting people about their stories. And so I'm really proud of the stuff we have up there, but it's really just sort of proof of concept where we're seeking core funding and we're seeking to expand our community of people that are contributing and editing and all of that so that this can be more representative. But I would say the success story is how people have responded to this framework. I'll tell you, like, I've been doing climate justice work for a number of years now, and no one's ever really, like, gotten in touch with me to talk about the end of the world before. And I don't believe it's the end of the world, but it can often feel that way. And it can feel like the stuff is dark and heavy and challenging. And for some reason, framing this around that that's okay and that it's safe, it's a safe place to talk about that stuff, people actually ask me to work on this stuff with them. And that's what's really blown me away, is just how people seem to be very ready for this type of a project. And the desire to not just frame it around like solutions and change making in the more literal sense, but to frame it around those steps that lead up to that, and to frame it around the courage and the compassion that you need to develop in order for that to feel meaningful and sustainable for you as a person. So we talk about self-care, we talk about community care, and how capitalism makes it very hard to take care of ourselves and each other, and that we need to actually focus on, you know, at a really basic material level, like lifting people up so that we can share these kinds of stories. But I think for me, the success has been how people have been drawn into this on the basis of the framework alone. And I hope there's many more successes in future years in terms of like projects that we've actually undertaken with this as a framework, with whether that's governments or businesses or just individuals or grassroots folks, and to be able to frame it around that is really meaningful to us. And I call that a success for me at least.
Definitely a success. I think something you said in there about self-care especially resonates, because we need so many people working on this issue from so many different angles. And I think a lot of us, you know, a lot of folks are getting caught up, like you said, they're getting paralysis or don't know how to plug in, or they are plugged in, but you know, they're burnt out. Like, this is a constant thing that's really not going to go away. And it feels like the weight of the world's on your shoulders sometimes. So I think that's a really key point, is taking care of yourself in this, because you're not going to be very effective. You can't really take care of other people until you yourself have your like basic needs met, you know, like physically, emotionally, you're in a good place to be able to give yourself back to others. So I think that is definitely a critical piece of all of that. You did mention a couple things earlier, but do you have any, like, what is your list of specific tips for folks on that aspect of this, if you have one?
If I'm understanding your question right, I think centering yourself and trying to at least like start building a list of what you do need in those moments when you recognize your own eco-anxiety. Like, have a little toolkit of your own on hand. And we've got a few resources on the website that we're building in terms of like a few fill in the blanks of things that actually do help center you and ground you. And we're always taking recommendations for tools that would be useful. But I think figuring out that way to sort of calm yourself down, calm your thoughts down, calm your breathing down, calm the physical reaction of eco-anxiety, in order to care for yourself, I think is really key. Like noting when it becomes acute. And if you're having acute anxiety all the time, like, again, I'm not a mental health professional, so please seek out help as you're experiencing these in that form. But for those of us who sort of are kind of going through our everyday life with a little bit of this underlying our actions, and then it bubbling up when we, you know, start to doom scroll on Twitter, or we, you know, see that headline or whatever, taking a second, like stopping your work, asking for the day off. Like, these are things that need to become more normal, I think, that we actually recognize that this is heavy work and that we will burn out if we don't at least normalize the fact that this is something we're all dealing with. I don't know about you, but I feel like with COVID, there's been this like new permission to be like, whoa, I'm struggling right now. And I think that universal experience of this pandemic, I think that's what a lot of us want in terms of being able to talk about our eco-anxieties, that it's reasonable that this would be affecting us, even if it's happening, you know, even if it's fires in California or floods in Bangladesh, that as we stop just centering ourselves in our climate stories, as we start to move to Act Two and actually see how interconnected we are with other communities, that we actually like build that solidarity piece into our story, that we actually change how we work and how we consume media so that we're hearing different voices and seeing different people. For me, at least, it humbles me. It helps me feel like the weight isn't on my shoulders. And please check out the micro podcast from Beth Sawin on our website for more on this. Like, she speaks so eloquently to the idea that we need to find our small piece of the puzzle. And that as you feel smaller, it's not about thinking of your power diminishing, but it's thinking about how interconnected and how well you fit with all of the other people and initiatives around you. and how you can find like peace in that actually. Like, I think we're offering actual peace in the idea that as we get closer together, yes, the world may fall apart more and more, but we have this ability to actually come together and support each other. It's why I really love your platform, Ryan, and how you're actually helping people connect with each other and not feel so alone in that translation of our feelings into actions. Because I think that that is where a lot of people get hung up. They know what this is about. They know why they feel anxious. But it's that question of who can actually help me connect into something that's bigger than just me.
Yeah, I think that is so key. You know, I still try to remind myself of that constantly whenever I feel too overwhelmed, is that like, I'm just one person. I can only do so much, but that there is some peace in that. It's like, as long as I'm doing what I can, whatever that means to me or anyone watching this, like you can have peace in knowing that you're doing your best and you just have one piece of this puzzle. We need a lot of people contributing whatever it is they bring to the table, whatever their, you know, superpowers are, or their spheres of influence, whatever they may be. But we're all like working on this together, and by no one person or even 100 or 1,000 people can do it on their own. So there is definitely some kind of serenity in that idea.
Yeah, I will say though, as people of privilege, especially for white people, when you start to think of it in these terms, you start to realize why like things like racism and inequality are so problematic, because it makes it impossible for us to meet in act two around the heart of the story and actually connect with each other. So sometimes I think for a lot of us who are in that demographic, a big part of the meaningful work we can do is to actually start to like undo those systems of oppression, because it makes it easier for like other groups and other work to flood in and take up space and help reorient us. So for me, another piece of that piece and knowing I'm just something small is recognizing that climate change is a symptom of like colonization and capitalism and all of these other things that started way before I was born. And I didn't ask to land in the story when I did. But now that I'm oriented to that and just how old this story is and where it's headed, like this is an exciting moment to be alive. And this is a really crucial, crucial decade for the species of art, like for everything. So like you couldn't ask in a way for a better chapter to open up to in terms of a really exciting story. So as much as I feel that weight, I try to interpret it as like, oh, we're at this turning point in a much broader story, and we can kind of embrace and get excited about that as much as it feels the heaviness and the anxiety as well.
Just to comment on that last thought real quick, because I think it's super important, is understanding how interconnected all of these systemic issues are, and how this is another thing that Beth Salen says a lot and works on a lot, is multi-solving. Mm-hmm. So like a lot of the climate solutions don't just make the climate better, but you know, they're improving the quality of life and addressing some of these systemic oppressions that we've kind of been handed by the past. And I do think there's, at my best, I am aware of that framing or idea that like this is, there's so much meaningful work to do. And compared to being alive in different times, you, like you said, this is about when we are, as a, not as much who we are. Like it is kind of a, I don't know if I want to say a privilege, but like there's so much meaningful work to be done, and to be a part of that can bring a lot more meaning to life, I guess. So I don't know. I kind of like, when I'm aware of that, I'm like, yes, that makes sense. But then, you know, day to day, it's like, oh my gosh, this is this is a lot. But I appreciate you raising that point.
Yeah, the key is to not let it become part of that overwhelming piece. It's just part of the complexity, and to embrace that complexity, I think, is certainly a tall order, but it's a really important first step, I think.
Do you have any, well, first off, I just want to say that Eco Anxious Stories, the website is fantastic. And we'll link to that. And definitely check that out. They have some great resources, podcasts, articles, infographics, a lot of stuff. But do you have any other recommended resources for people or any specific ones on your site that was really useful to your understanding of this topic or can be helpful for folks working their way through this right now? Could be books, podcasts, videos, whatever it may be.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many, it's such a great community of people working on this topic, for sure. If you're on Twitter and, you know, looking for people to connect with in around this, we're very nice and generous and we'll connect you into different folks. But I want to plug like Good Grief Network as a group that's doing great work in more of a like a 10-step program. Like they're not just doing podcasts, they're actually leading people through training. So that's a really awesome one to check out. A new newsletter that's being drafted by, created by Britt Ray. Dr. Britt Ray is Gen Dread, GENDREAD. Great newsletter that's really like much more timely than our content has been like getting out lately. She's really good at sort of regularly updating us on what's going on in this conversation. Mary Anais Higlar and her work is really has been formative for me in understanding how existential crises look and feel to people of color and people, Black people, especially in her context, who have, you know, have histories of genocide, of degradation in this way, have a different relationship to this this crisis, and super important to be learning from them. The Climate Psychology Alliance is a good one if you're interested in kind of being connected into this work, as is climateandmind.com. I believe that's the right one for Andrew Bryant's great work on this. There's a ton, but we're going to be listing more of that kind of stuff on our website as we develop it. And we really encourage you to get in touch with us if you want to sort of be a part of that list. On our website, awesome. I love everything. I'm spoiled by the folks who have contributed. This video at the bottom here, Let Me Out, was one of our videos that I actually turn to all the time when I'm feeling eco-anxious. It's just a short video with a bit of a poem read over it, and it really chills me out and helps me refocus. So I'll pull that one out today as a special one.
Amazing. Do you have any like call to action for listeners or any like final key takeaway message for folks?
I would say for your own eco-anxiety, just know that you're not alone. This is the key message I would say is just if you are feeling these feelings, I'm glad you are, and I don't want them to be debilitating and I don't want you to struggle alone. But these are we should anticipate lots more of this. And I think it's a turning point for us in realizing that we need to create supports for people. So thank you for being a part of that. If you're feeling like you don't know how to talk about this stuff with other people, I would just encourage folks to think of this three-part model and think of what matters to them, what's at stake in their community, what they want, and what they think it'll take. And in terms of just trying to find some meaning, you can start small, but think about who might share some of that story with you. Who else is a character in your story? And maybe framing it for them in those terms is a new approach than just, you know, assuming that they don't care or that they don't know enough.
Awesome.
Thanks for all your questions, though. They've been great.
You have been fantastic. I think, Michaela, we have a question from Kyra, if you want to give her the ability to hop on here.
Yeah. So, Kyra, if you are still here, could you try turning on your video and you can ask the question in front of everyone?
Hi. Can you all hear me? My name is Kira. It's okay. The Y trips everybody.
Sorry about that.
Oh, it's all good. My question for you, Rachel, is like, how do you inspire others around you, like beyond your circle that might be like more environmentally conscientious and whatnot? Cause like what I've encountered are lots of people who are older than me. I'm 23. So I think inspiring like older generations and whatnot to like get involved, that it's not too late, because when I bring it up, they don't like to go there because it makes them anxious. And you know, I don't want it to just be like, oh, the young people are gonna solve and save the day, like stuff. Like, what do you recommend?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, I mean, whenever I'm doing communications work, I'm always trying to think of my audience and really trying to think in terms of these stories. Like, I've got a story and I know what I sort of like think about what they should maybe be doing in my story, but to try to suspend that a little bit and go in more asking about their story. And again, we're trying to figure out that connection between the complexity of life and the climate crisis. So maybe for them, it's like thinking back to what life was like when they were growing up and what kind of like, were they worried about the Cold War, about nuclear, you know, were they worried about famine or economic decline? Is there anything about those experiences that they can kind of relate to what we're experiencing now? Trying to figure out a language or a framework that is familiar and useful to the person you're really talking to. And if you don't know what that is, asking. It can be a great way to start a conversation that's about climate change that's not actually about climate change. Like today, I've told you all a lot about racial injustice without actually framing this as a talk about racial injustice. I tricked you. So, I mean, it's not about tricking. It's about engaging. It's about actually authentically trying to find common ground. And so that's a good way to start, is just to figure out a common thing that you could relate to climate change, but maybe less directly than diving in with that education or that info. And then moving to the second part of the story, what maybe are they feeling about that? Are they feeling like they are, you know, washing their hands of the situation? Are they feeling unsure of what they could do since they're from the generation that keeps getting condemned as being the cause of all of this? Trying to figure out how they feel and trying to understand that might be a way to, again, help them realize that maybe they do love people who care about this stuff, or they do love the cause already. And then in terms of an action, that's where it really depends on why you're engaging them. But I think helping them see other people that look like them in action is a really useful way, again, that you're not hitting them over the head with this is what you should be doing, but this is what it looks like when someone does this, and this is what the impact is. So that could be finding an older person that's encouraged you or helped you materially, maybe, you know, helped you out as you were struggling with burnout or something, and showing how meaningful that was to have solidarity between generations. There's lots of ideas, but I think starting with that story framework can help you kind of think about a more useful way to approach people if you've been struggling in the past. Yeah.
I think also, Kira, I don't know enough about, or as much of the, about this as I'd like, but Rachel, you might know more, but motivational interviewing is a tool that I have heard about a few times now. And it is very similar to what Rachel was just saying. It's about like connecting on those common values, like finding that common ground between you and them, because we all have common ground. And once you figure out what that is, you know, you don't guilt or shame anyone in these conversations, but you discover what it is that matters to them. And then you can try to connect that dot to climate and why it matters to you. I think that's a useful way to think about it.
This is all really helpful information. Yeah. I think, yeah, finding that commonality. Yeah. You don't want to attack people for, you know, they're not the only ones responsible. So
yeah, again, going back to that idea of when we all are rather than who we are and who's to blame. You don't have to be to blame to be at hand. And so if you're at hand now, that's really where we need folks. And older folks have a lot of influence, especially with politicians. So that can be another angle. Thanks for your question.
Thank you.
Does anybody else have any more questions for Rachel or Ryan or myself? I don't see any more in the chat, so I think that might have been it.
Yeah, it looks like we are about ready to wrap up. It looks like Doug shared a link to Catherine Hayhoe's TED Talk, which is on talking about climate is one of the most important things you can do. Mm-hmm. I think that ties in really well, actually, with this conversation. So thank you, Doug, because I mean, it not only starts to normalize these feelings of eco-anxiety and like, but it's all about that connection with other people. And I think, like you said, Rachel, we really need to start collaborating and working together to be able to make the scale of the changes that we need to see. Mm-hmm. So talking is like a great first step to take. And whether that be like, you know, with other people is what this is referring to. But also if you haven't done the work of reflecting on it yourself and working through these feelings and emotions,
those are definitely two very powerful actions to take to start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think in terms of talking about climate change, again, it doesn't have to be that you're coming in with these like five facts or something like that. You're an expert in your story and your perspective, and you get power actually from framing things that way. So you don't have to speak on behalf of all the science or on what we should do, but even just talking about how you feel about what's wrong and what you would want to happen if you had all the power in the world, that can be great for sparking imagination and getting people out of sort of the tunnel vision that they might be applying.
That's an awesome point. Thank you so much again for coming on today. It's been such a pleasure getting to hear your story and getting to, you know, understand this topic on a deeper level.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
So much.
You're welcome.
Absolutely amazing. Last thing, Rachel, for folks who want to stay in touch with you or keep up with your work, what do you recommend they do, or where should they follow you?
I just took the screen down, but please do find us at EcoAnxious CAF on Twitter and on Facebook, and then EcoAnxious on Instagram. I would say Instagram and Twitter are kind of where we are mostly. And then the website itself hasn't been updated in a little while, but we will be popping some new content on there pretty soon here. And there is a fair amount on there to navigate already if you'd like to check out what we're doing and get inspired to maybe submit your own story. My personal Twitter is also available to you at Rachel Molina. If you'd like to connect with me directly, I'd love to chat with you. So please do reach out and be part of the conversation.
Awesome.
Amazing. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, everyone. Take care of yourselves, and we will be in touch. So that is the end of our show. Thank you so much for joining us today. If you enjoyed this conversation, you may also appreciate signing up for the Crowdsourcing Sustainability newsletter that I write most weeks. This will also give you access to our CS Slack community. And there's a link to that in the show notes, along with several other links we referred to today. Lastly, please do consider giving us a review to help us grow this community and get this information out to more people. We would really, really appreciate that. And I think that is all we've got for you today. So thank you again. Take care, and we'll talk to you soon.